This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about searching for the truth. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Investigative reporter Susanna Cahalan was deep in a rabbit hole, looking into one of the most famous psychological experiments of all time, the Rosenhan experiment. It was named after David Rosenhan, a psychologist at Stanford University. In the early 1970s, he got himself admitted to a psychiatric hospital by pretending to hear voices.
This was really punk rock. This was like a real brave and out there renegade kind of thing to do.
The experiment was meant to put psychiatric diagnoses to the test. How accurate were they? Would staff at the hospital realize he was faking? That was the main question, but there was more.
What was it like to be a patient? What was it like to be labeled with a mental illness? How were you treated? I think that was a big part of it as well.
Rosenhan described his experiences in a 1973 paper called On Being Sane in Insane Places.
This was published in Science, one of the most premier scientific journals in the world, and continues to be.
In the paper, Rosenhan also described recruiting several other people, pseudo-patients, to get themselves admitted to different psychiatric institutions, to fake hearing voices that said the words thud, empty, and hollow. Susanna found all of this fascinating.
These people were committed. They were committed to a psychiatric hospital, and they could not leave unless they were, you know, released. So this was pretty badass, I have to say. I mean, there was no script. You know, after the thud, empty, hollow, you're on your own in there.
The experiment and paper were hugely influential.
It's still taught in most Psych 101 courses. It's also one of the most cited psychology papers of all time.
It contributed to a shift away from institutionalizing people with mental illnesses. Susanna wanted to write a book about this famous experiment. Rosenhan had died in 2012, but she was hoping to find the pseudo-patients he recruited to go undercover, to fake hearing voices. Their identities had never been revealed.
Part of this that has never been told before, because the participants in this study have never come above ground.
Who were they? Susanna dug around online and found nothing. So she reached out to one of Rosenhan's friends, a former colleague at Stanford, psychologist Lee Ross. She talked to him at his office, and being a reporter, Susanna recorded everything.
Okay. So, how can I be helpful?
Okay, so
Susanna explained that she had gotten really interested in the Rosenhan experiment.
At some point he says, you know, where is my Rosenhan file?
Where is my Rosenhan file?
And he actually brought it out and showed me this file.
He let her photocopy the pages, which had been written by Rosenhan.
And I remember getting to my car and just sitting there, just diving already into the files, just so excited.
This was an absolute treasure trove of information.
It had lists of hospitals. It had an unpublished book. It had diary entries. I saw one of the first pseudo-patient lists. And that pseudo-patient list became kind of my Rosetta Stone, essentially, to try to track these people down. I mean, I can still conjure the feeling of, like, the blood rushing to my face, you know, getting bright red, my heart beating.
Journalists love a good chase, getting closer and closer to the truth. But for Susanna, this story was also deeply personal, which made her all the more eager to find these pseudo-patients. But when she did, the truth turned out to be far more complicated than she had anticipated.
I had spent so much time with Rosenhan's work, with his family, with his friends. I had spent time in his head, and this felt like a betrayal.
Susanna spent a long time piecing together the details of the famous experiment. And thanks to her work, we'll hear for the first time the voices of the pseudo-patients. Justin Cramon picks up the story from here.
The reason Susanna was so invested in writing about the Rosenhan experiment is connected to a life-changing experience she had when she was 24. In 2009, Susanna was very nearly sent to a psychiatric ward herself. She'd been acting erratically.
One moment, I'd be thrilled. I mean, most excited and happy I'd ever felt in my life. And then the next moment, I would actually be under my desk crying.
She became convinced her apartment was infested with bedbugs, even though an exterminator assured her there were no signs of them. One side of her body periodically went numb. She worked for a newspaper at the time, and once, during a serious interview with a source, she broke out into uncontrollable laughter. Sometimes she'd stare into the distance, unresponsive. Her behavior pointed to a psychotic break.
So we went and saw a neurologist who then ordered up an EEG.
In the waiting room at the hospital, Susanna had a seizure. And for this reason, she was admitted in an epilepsy unit.
When I was hospitalized, I was at my most acutely psychotic. And at that point, the rule out diagnosis initially was bipolar 1. And then as my psychosis intensified, it became schizoaffective disorder. One morning, this man walks in the door. He's middle-aged. He has a thick mustache. This was a doctor named Suhail Najjar, and he asked me to draw a clock. When I was finished, Dr. Najjar looked down on the page, and he was, beaming. He saw that I had written all the numbers from 1 to 12, smushed together on the right side, with basically nothing on the left-hand side. There was something going on in the right-hand side of my brain, and ultimately, I tested positive for a newly discovered disease called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis.
It's an inflammatory condition that attacks receptors in the brain. Susanna had a physical illness that made her psychotic. They could give her medicine to treat the physical problem and bring her back to sanity.
It was a long journey. The whole journey took about a year and a half to really return.
And in 2012, Susanna published a book about that journey, Brain on Fire, which became a sensation.
Susanna Cahalan is with us now.
Susanna Cahalan, welcome to Fresh Air.
You must be the famous Susanna.
One woman's month of madness.
The woman who was told that her brain was on fire.
After the book came out, Susanna got thousands of emails from people all over the world who wanted to share their experiences with psychiatric treatment.
They wanted me to connect them to a doctor. They wanted me to talk to the family. They wanted me to come visit them in the hospital. And for a good year or so, I did. I felt a lot of guilt. And I felt that it was my, for lack of a better word, destiny. This was what I was meant to do.
But Susanna didn't feel equipped to advise all these patients.
And I had to make the decision to step back because it's out of my depth.
The only thing she really knew how to do was investigate stories and write. So this project of finding the pseudopatients from the 1970s Rosenhan experiment, the study that showed how bad psychiatric hospitals were, felt like the right way to invest her energy, shed new light on these institutions after her own brush with them. Digging through the files she had gotten from Lee Ross, she discovered a reference to a guy named W. Underwood. It was a note scribbled in the margin about one of the pseudo-patients. Susanna realized it could be the patient's real name.
And I was able to track that name down to a list of graduate students at Stanford that would have made sense during the timing of the study. And I found him and emailed him. And then on my birthday of all days, I received a gift in response. And it read, "Hi, Susanna. I was indeed in the pseudo-patient study. I can't imagine what I would have to add, but if you want to talk, that would be fine. Bill, you." I wanted to talk.
Susanna booked a flight to Austin, Texas, to meet Bill Underwood, her first pseudo-patient.
He was in his 70s, very warm.
Susanna switched on the recorder.
Geez, I mean, I've always been at UT, which was a fairly different environment from Stanford.
And his wife, Marion, was there as well. And she's like all sunshine and love.
I have a very, obviously, Texas draw. I've lived my whole life in Texas.
In fact, the only time they'd left Texas was for this brief stint 40 years before, when Bill was in grad school at Stanford and he got recruited for the study. Bill thought it was a cool idea. He had a rebellious streak in him. And this Gonzo experiment resonated with that. Susanna asked how long it took the doctor at the psychiatric hospital to diagnose Bill with schizophrenia.
I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And then they said, okay, we're going to admit you to the hospital.
He said goodbye to Marion, and they took him into this psychiatric hospital, Agnews State Hospital, around 14 miles from Stanford. Susanna asked Bill if Rosenhan taught him how to avoid taking the psychiatric medications.
Just put it in your mouth, close the mouth, you know, slip it under your tongue, drink the water, wander aimlessly for a couple of minutes, go into the bathroom, spit them in the toilet. Here's the flaw in this plan. This medication has a coating on it. The coating eventually melts in your mouth. The medication itself is painful.
Bitter?
But not bitter, it burned.
It burned?
It burned my mouth. So I swallowed it. And so went out into the ward. Boom, I'm head down.
Marion had no idea what they were doing with her husband. And so at their home in Austin, all these years later, Susanna asks Marion to describe visiting Bill at the hospital.
He's just sitting at this long table, you know, with just all these chairs, with his head down on the table. And I'm like trying to talk to him, are you okay? You know, whispering. And he wouldn't talk to me. He just said, I'm sleepy. And I'm like, well, what's going on? You know, tell him about it. He said, I can't talk. I just want to sleep. And it's like, I thought that they had just done something horrible to him. I was already thinking shock therapy, lobotomy, you know, whatever.
Susanna was surprised to learn all this.
This is not a good thing to have happen to one of his graduate students who's going undercover. I mean, he didn't prep Bill properly at all. The fact is, Rosenhan was putting other people in danger.
Susanna found out Bill had been on a locked ward.
Bill had these uncanny, kind of one floor of the cuckoo's nest type exchanges with other patients. You know, a man particularly who would crawl around the floor like a baby.
Just, you know, hands and knees. He was fairly young. He was in his 20s. I was talking with some other guys at one point. We were just standing around talking. He's crawling around. He crawls over to our area, gets up, and we start talking about college. He'd been at junior college, community college, somewhere in the area, and so we started talking about, you know, college courses, you know, and how hard it was and all that kind of stuff. And then we finished our conversation. He got back on his hands and he could crawl off.
But he'd have these moments of real humanity with these patients, very different than the experience of what the psychiatrists and nurses were doing on the floor, where they were not treating these people as humans at all.
We hung around a lot and we played cards. I don't think everyone won a single game.
What cards did you play?
We played Crazy Eight a lot.
Crazy Eight. That's great. It seems like treatment was non-existent, really, on the ward, besides just the daily doses of Thorazine.
And when Bill decided he wanted to leave,
I asked them to release me. I'm a voluntary admission. I want to request a release.
And just like that, he got out.
And how did you feel when they finally told you, like, okay, you can go?
I felt really good. It was like the air was fresher, the sky was bluer, the grass was greener.
Susanna flew home, elated.
I felt so great about finding Bill. I had, you know, unmasked one of the pseudo patients. I was on my way to unmasking more.
Bill had given her the real name of another pseudo patient, a guy in that same grad school class as Bill. His name was Harry Lando.
I mean, so I was a grad student. I was a student of Rosenhan's.
And how old were you then at this time?
24.
I had a landline. I remember the long cord, and I was like pacing with the cord as much as it would go.
So I took a seminar in psychopathology from Rosenhan. I think there were about eight of us in the seminar, and I was really intrigued.
It sounded like Harry was waiting for someone to make this call, like he had been expecting this call for decades, and it had finally come.
Harry described himself as a little more of an outsider than Bill. During his time at Stanford, he was unhappy. He had trouble connecting with his peers. One day, Rosenhan had invited the class over for dinner to recruit pseudo-patients for the study.
I did feel like there was a bit of a sales job.
But Rosenhan didn't have to sell hard. Harry was into it.
Wow, this is exciting. This is interesting. I felt like we had pretty minimal coaching, maybe 15 minutes of coaching, very little instruction. You know, we heard voices, an empty thud and hollow. And
wow.
It really made me nervous. I almost felt like I was going into the lion's den here.
Harry gets evaluated, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and admitted to a different psychiatric hospital. His first night, also like Bill, Harry was given medication.
We were, you know, told about tonguing pills. It didn't help me much when I got liquid Thorazine, but I remember, you know, Rosenhan's lecture on tonguing pills and thinking, okay, Dave, what do I do now? And I just swallowed it.
Once again, we're in a situation where someone is being given an inappropriate, possibly dangerous medication with no guardrails at all. And I think, oh, this is going to be a complete disaster.
But what she heard from Harry was pretty different.
What I will say is the nurses in general, I had a lot of interaction with them. The nurses' station was fully open to patients. You know, both genders were on the ward. There were guitar jam sessions.
Oh, really?
And then he proceeds to tell me that the nurses and the patients were like one happy family.
I'm almost feeling emotional as I talk about
it. Oh, wow.
Such a moving experience.
Wow. In terms of these jam sessions, do you remember what they played?
Folk music, probably some Peter, Paul, and Mary.
That is amazing.
It was not a locked ward. People were really engaged with each other, and it was a kind of kumbaya environment. There were books, there were music. It was a place that augmented empathy and connection.
I think I mentioned to you, I was not a very happy graduate student. So then I get to the hospital and seeing these patients who I came to care about, who I thought were good people, caring people, who had life problems. I found it an empowering experience. I found Stanford rather dehumanizing. Mm. When I was in the hospital, I was treated with regard by both staff and patients. You know, all the things that Rosenhan talked about, I, if anything, had the opposite experience.
I think that's
the takeaway here is that 29 days in the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, he had a far better time than he did as a graduate student at Stanford University.
Ultimately, Harry was released with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. He was back at Stanford, ready to report his experiences. But he had very little contact with Rosenhan.
Okay, after all that excitement, then I'm waiting. I don't see Rosenhan. He's not around. I'm waiting.
Harry told Susanna that the data he collected for the study wasn't used in the final paper.
You know, when Rosenhan decided not to include your research in the study, what were your thoughts? Were you disappointed? How did you feel?
I think that I was a little bit pissed. I felt like I kind of had the rug pulled out from under me.
Yeah.
Because he never told me about that. And
how did you learn?
By reading the article.
No!
Harry was mentioned in a footnote in Rosenhan's paper, without being named, as an additional pseudo-patient whose data was tainted and therefore wouldn't be used. And by now, after uncovering two of the pseudo-patients, Susanna's perspective on Rosenhan was really shifting.
I felt a little deflated, I think. So now I'm at this point where I'm questioning a lot.
Like, was Rosenhan's experiment done carefully? Did it ignore or cherry-pick data? Susanna wanted to know more.
I discovered that there were very close friends of Rosenhan that would have definitely been around during the study and would have known details about it. And I found out that though David's best friend, Perry London, was no longer alive, his wife, Vivian London, was.
So one day, Susanna gets Vivian London on the phone.
Oh, David, since 1950, my late ex-husband, Perry London, was his closest friend.
Right. Susanna asked Vivian about any details she might know regarding the other pseudo-patients.
One of, in particular, was a female artist.
I don't know an artist. It doesn't ring any bells.
Susanna strikes out a few times. But then she mentions another pseudo-patient in this study who was a little older than the others.
He had just recently got his doctorate in psychology. And he had a previous life as a businessman.
Maury?
Who is Maury?
Was he an accountant in Los Angeles? That outline matches. That was a good friend of Perry's in Los Angeles. And he was 10 years older than Perry? That could be.
Yeah.
Morris Leibowitz.
I think I almost whooped. I was like, oh, I was pumped. And then there's just a flicker. Like in my mind, I just recall that Leibowitz, there was a name like that somewhere. I could not, for the life of me, get it at that moment. But I knew that name was somewhere in David's files.
She gets off the phone. starts going through the files again. And there it is.
I found it. Use Leibovitz here. A note to himself in the outline for his unpublished book.
This was a book Rosenhan had a contract to write about the experiment, but never completed.
I had found my man. I started to think about that note. Use Leibovitz. What does that mean? What does it mean to use his story in an area where he was providing biographical detail for one of the pseudo-patients? He was going to insert someone's biography into the text. So I'm sitting there with the file in my hand, and all of a sudden, it just hits me. I know something. I start thinking about the various other issues that I had found. You know, not only just the issue with Harry, the safety issues with Bill, but there were other things, too.
Details that were just not adding up.
You have the numbers that I keep finding that are incorrect in his personal writings of things like patients at the hospital or, you know, number of days hospitalized. And these numbers kept changing, and they're not numbers that should change. Discrepancies in almost every piece of writing that he had. At first, it was a little bit. And then as I started to change my perspective, there was an enormous amount of evidence. Everything I would find, there'd be another question. There'd be another issue.
Susanna had the medical records from Rosenhan's own stay in the psychiatric hospital when he'd posed as a patient at the beginning of the study.
The medical record completely contradicts what Rosenhan writes about in On Being Sane and Insane Places. In fact, he includes an excerpt from the medical record that was completely rewritten. I knew then that I was dealing with a study that was not only sloppy, one of the most famous psychology papers of all time was looking like it might be a fraud.
From what Susanna could find and put together, Rosenhan never sent anyone else into a psychiatric hospital. The evidence suggests that after Bill's and Harry's problematic hospitalizations, he actually made up the remaining pseudo-patients and their data. Morris Leibovitz had died, but Susanna tracked down his family, who assured her he never participated and was, in fact, out of the country during the entire span of Rosenhan's experiment. Several of the pseudo-patient's biographies, Susanna discovered, appeared similarly suspicious or borrowed.
I felt panic. I was working on a book based on this amazing, transformative study, and now I was realizing that I was clinging to air. I had spent so much time with Rosenhan's work, with his family, with his friends. I had spent time in his head, and this felt like a betrayal.
Susanna made a trip back to see Lee Ross, the psychologist at Stanford who'd given her some of Rosenhan's files. She delivered all the information and her suspicions to hear his take.
I have to ask you, I just have a feeling, and there's things that are, to me, are problematic in terms of things that I found.
She stumbles for a minute, trying to think how to lay it all down, until she finally just asks Ross if he thinks David Rosenhan's pseudo-patients might not be real. And he says,
would I be shocked? Yes. Would I be incredulous? No.
To hear Lee Ross, who I respect so much, that was affirming for me.
She knew then that she'd glimpsed something true. She could see it in the way Rosenhan's life went after the experiment.
He started working on his book. He got a contract from Doubleday with a nice advance. He wrote a good deal of it, but never handed it in, and was actually sued by Doubleday and had to return his advance. He never wrote on the topic of serious mental illness again. A lot of his friends said that he didn't really like talking about the study.
And maybe most convincingly, since Susanna published her discoveries about Rosenhan in a book she titled The Great Pretender, no other pseudo-patient or relative of one has come forward, suggesting they just didn't exist.
It's taken me a long time to be able to say concretely that this was a fraud. It's hard for me to say it. I still think the study is important and illuminated a lot about the experience of being labeled with a psychiatric condition. I do think it's important that it was not true.
Because so much that came afterward in the history of American psychiatry was influenced by Rosenhan's work.
At the time, we had already started the big wave of deinstitutionalization that started in the 1950s, and this continued it into the next decade, closing even greater numbers of institutions and leaving fewer and fewer places for people who were acutely psychotically ill to get care. Well, a great majority of those people ended up in prison and jails. It was a shadow mental health care system we're still dealing with today.
That story was reported by Justin Cramon. Check out KQED's Snap Judgment, where Susanna Cahalan tells the full story of her own brush with the mental health care system. We'll link to the podcast in our show notes.